and welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, and I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin. And we've got a great week for you. We're going to catch up on a whole lot of news, including privacy and global issues. Our deep dive segment today is going to be on what the internet is going to look like in 2028. And there are some major players and major forces worldwide working to make that happen right now. We're introducing a new segment in this show called Breaches of the Week. So I'm going to sit back and I'm going to tell you about all the data breaches that happen that may or may not affect you, your friends, and all of your lives. I'm going to answer questions from the audience and we're going to have a great time. So sit back, relax, enjoy the hour. And as always, we're going to start with the news. And in Amazon news, and before we dive into Amazon itself, I would like to state this from a cybersecurity standpoint. Amazon is one of the largest providers of internet cloud service, like hosting services, in the world. So, you know, obviously they have their own shopping website and Amazon Prime. They also host Netflix. A lot of people don't know that. And some of the largest websites in the world. So many corporations and tech companies go to Amazon to get hosted. Now, there are other large competitors to Amazon as well. So Microsoft, for example, IBM has SoftLayer, and there's a whole bunch of others. But one of the things that these companies want is operational security. And so if we are looking at making sure that you know, the data is secure, one, we're talking about technological solutions so hackers can't get to it on the internet, but we're also talking about physical solutions as well. So we keep the locations, or rather Amazon, Microsoft, et cetera, would want to keep the locations of their data centers secret. Oftentimes they are renting from other data centers as well that are generic in nature. And so the name on the door isn't going to say Amazon, you know, data center. It might be like ABC hosting data center, of which Amazon owns 90% of the floor space for their servers, you know, stuff like that. And so for operational security and oftentimes national security, especially since Amazon has contracts with government agencies like the CIA, you know, they want to make sure that these locations are secret, that the processes and procedures of how they interact with these locations and facilities are secret as well. Well, and here's what we're getting to. WikiLeaks, and you probably know where I'm going now, basically was uncovered. Somebody sent them a document from late 2015, early 2016, that had every location of Amazon's data structure, data infrastructure, all their data centers, all their processes and procedures, and they put that out online. And so obviously Amazon is not a fan of this. I'm sure they've significantly added to that list since then. They might have changed processes and controls and all that, but a lot of that is still going to be relevant. If they've got data centers out there, and let's say they've added 20% more, now there's a list of 80% of their data centers are. And so what does that mean for, you know, trying to physically access servers to, you know, insert surveillance or steal them or, you know, whatever that is going to be, whether it's nation state hijacking, groups like Anonymous, whatever that is. So that is a serious, serious problem that Amazon is now facing. And hopefully that, you know, Amazon will be able to take care of that. But we're about to see what happens when the major data center list for a major, major corporation gets exposed online for all the world to see. And that is your Amazon News of the Week. And in password news, and there is actually password news, the state of California that has pretty much put all of Silicon Valley in a tizzy with a lot of the laws that they're trying to pass by 2020, just came out with a new one that said any manufacturer selling devices within the state of California, these are wireless access points and firewalls and video cameras and whatever, can no longer use weak passwords. They have to be aggressive passwords right from the manufacturer. Now, this is very interesting. Because a lot of people, you know, you walk into your local big box retailer and go buy a router for your house, and the password is password, or the password is 1234, or it's admin, or it's something basic. And these are designed for ease of use. You plug it in, you fire it up, you know, you and you get online as fast as you possibly can. And that is one of the big benefits of it. But it comes with a sacrifice of having weak security, weak passwords. And when we are looking at infections or vulnerabilities that infections can hit, oftentimes they're looking for this. So in 2016, we had a massive infection called Mirai that hit millions of IoT devices worldwide to weaponize them against targets. And the hacker found these devices by basically searching the web and then testing the top 50 passwords that the device makers were using, like password and admin and 1234 and 0000, you know, that kind of stuff. And so California is putting this up. Now, obviously, the device manufacturers are not a big fan of this because this causes them to rethink how they are producing their firmware, how they are creating more aggressive passwords and all that, how they're linking these things, and it's going to cause them more money and headache. But again, it's for the benefit of the user, because at the end of the day, I would hope that you'd want your product to be as safe and as secure as it could be, because, you know, that's your reputation on the line. So California just passed that law, and we'll see where that goes. And California is also doing a couple of other things as well, like passing their own general data protection law that would allow California citizens to do essentially what the European Union passed earlier this year, which is to get their information, see their information from a Google or a Facebook or any one of those big companies, and then have the ability to permanently delete it. Now, this has really caused Google, Facebook, and the rest of Silicon Valley serious headaches, and has pretty much activated an entire army of lobbyists in Washington, D.C., to try to create a federal law to ban California's law, to have the federal state override the local state. And the reason being is that their argument is, we don't want to deal with 50 different privacy laws in 50 different states. We would like one nationwide law. Otherwise, it's going to be virtually impossible to comply with this. And I completely understand their position. I really do, because that would be an utter nightmare. If we're looking at the whole, you know, internet tax thing, it's the same thing. Do we have 50 states all doing one different thing, or do we create a uniform tax or no tax, for internet? It'd be easier just to have one uniform flat rate for everything, or no rate, but do it at the federal level. And so in this sense, Silicon Valley has this. But the fear, though, is that, great, now we're going to have a federal law and they're going to pour a ton of money into lobbyists, et cetera, to make sure that the laws are weak and more favorable to them versus consumer protection. Now, that's the speculation. I'm not saying that that is what would happen if we have a federal law. It might be very good and very stringent, and it may not be favorable to Silicon Valley. But, you know, that is the debate right now. So you can make up your own mind on that. I'm not going to tell you, what to think. Although I do think that they will do everything they can, and this is my opinion, to try and make that as weak as possible, because that is in their best interest. I'm talking about Google, Facebook, etc. So we'll see where that goes. But that is your password/California news of the week. And in espionage news, we're going to be talking about China today. And this is a really, really interesting case. Now, the Bloomberg, the publication, recently came out in the last couple of weeks with an article that said that a manufacturer named Supermicro, they make computer servers in the same way that like HP and Dell and all that, but they make more generic, they use more generic parts. Now, Supermicro was hit and infiltrated by the Chinese government. The People's Liberation Army was able to put operatives into the Supermicro production plant where the servers were made and insert microprocessors into the servers that were being built. And this microprocessor was the size of a grain of rice. Now, these servers get shipped to companies like Apple and Amazon and the US Navy and other things like this. And Bloomberg basically dropped a bomb saying that these companies are running servers where the Chinese government has, basically secret surveillance, secret data exfiltration integrated into the hardware. Basically, it's a supply chain hack. And so these companies came out, Apple, et cetera, that basically said, no, we unequivocally deny that this ever happened and blah, 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 blah. And so the cybersecurity community, and I've done a couple of daily videos on this, has basically broken up into two camps. One that says, well, this is a very possible hack. We know these kinds of hacks have happened before, not with China, versus the people that say, no, this is just, this is sensationalism and all of that. Now, we fast forward again to a week, and this is a little bit of a complex news story, but it's really, really interesting. Bloomberg came out with another article that basically stated, you know, yes, this actually happened. And here is Yossi Applebaum. He's one of the co-founders, co-chairs of a company called Sepio Systems that does hardware cybersecurity. And Yossi went on record basically saying, yes, we found this in a major U.S. telecom. And for non-disclosure purposes, NDAs, all that kind of stuff, the U.S. telecom was not disclosed, but a major U.S. telecom was running Supermicro infrastructure, and they found these microprocessors. And so the question then becomes, well, is Bloomberg and Yossi basically going to, and Sepio Systems, going to ruin their reputation by coming out and making these statements? Because if it's ever found out that they lied, I mean, reputations are ruined, especially on the Sepio Systems side, you know, because they obviously don't have the deep pockets like a Bloomberg or an Apple or all of that. Or is Apple and the U.S. government and Amazon and all this, their vehement denials, is that accurate? And so I'll let you make up your mind. I mean, if I'm looking at this, I'm thinking to myself, Yossi, et cetera, has everything to lose, you know, if he is wrong or he is lying. And it would be in the best strategic intelligence interest of the United States to deny this right now as they start to identify this this problem. So for all we know, Apple is crawling with these things. And I'm not saying they are because I don't know this, but let's assume for a moment that Apple is crawling with these infected Supermicro servers. They might need 6 months to a year or more to remove all of this stuff. Or the U.S. intelligence says, you know what, keep this stuff in place, but we are going to start putting fake information through to see what happens, or tracking pixels to see where the information goes, or whatever, wherever that is. And so we don't necessarily know everything. And this is, again, my opinion. I mean, you tell me. You could be on one camp or the other. I just don't think all the facts are in, and I think there is going to be more here. I think we're at the tip of the iceberg. But I thought that was just a fascinating news article. You know, and it's been an ongoing debate of serious consequence for basically the United States. So that is your espionage news of the week. You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And in your dark web news of the week, we're going to be talking about a guy named Gaël Valerius. Now, Gaël Valerius is a French national, lives in France. And he ran, and I do say ran, one of the largest illegal narcotics trade markets in the dark web. His nickname was Oxy Monster. You can figure that one out. And he sold things like Oxycontin, heroin, and other narcotics illegally on the dark web, oftentimes trading it for Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. Now, these guys are obviously hunted by Interpol and wanted and all this kind of stuff. And there Gaul is in France, you know, I guess fine. I mean, he was living there, and there wasn't many issues with him, I guess, in the French authorities. But he decided to fly to America and land in Atlanta. And the reason why he did that was because he was entering something called the World Beard and Mustache Competition. And basically, he has a beard. And if you look at pictures of him, it looks like he's got like one of those like ZZ Top beards. This dude really loves his beard. And so he made the choice to say, you know what? I'm going to enter this competition. And he was promptly arrested when he landed in Atlanta, you know, for this competition, because he is a internationally wanted criminal in the dark web. And so, guys, crime doesn't pay. Your beard might, but crime doesn't pay, I guess, if you win that competition. So, yes, we caught one of the largest drug dealers on the dark web because of his beard. And I thought that was absolutely hysterical, and I wanted to share it with all of you. But that is your dark web news of the week. And in more Google news, and I know the deep dive segment today is going to be talking a bit about Google, but this is another aspect of Google. Two congressmen in a bipartisan effort basically sent Google a letter saying, we think you're violating the Children's Online Protection Act. And this is a law from 1988 that basically says children under the age of 13 are very stringently regulated on how these corporations can store and collect information on 13-year-olds. And the two congressmen pointed to YouTube as the issue. Now, here's the thing. When you sign up for a YouTube account or a Facebook account or anything else, basically Facebook, Google, YouTube, etc. says, are you over the age of 13? Yes or no? And you can say, yes, I am over the age of 13. And they say, okay, here's your account. Welcome aboard. And that's it. There's no controls. There's no stringency. And so Multiple child advocacy groups have come out and said, well, there's no reason why a 10-year-old who can read, write, and use a mouse can click, yes, I am 13 or older, and get a YouTube account, which then exposes them to things that no 10-year-old should really be exposed to at that age. This is why we have movie ratings, PG-13, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and you can debate on that one of where that's gone in the last 20 years, because I remember PG movies when I was a kid versus today. It's a little different, you know, but nevertheless, this is the contention, and multiple child advocacy groups have also sent in letters as well saying, you know, Google may be violating this. You know, and now obviously Google and YouTube have come out and said, you know, we take child privacy very seriously. That's why we have like a YouTube Kids design that has content designed for 13 and under, you know, and they do have this. They do. I've seen it, you know, and it has content that is supposed to be very kid friendly. Nothing's going to hopefully get through that would be in adult nature. But again, there's no controls. Now, what this speaks to overall fundamentally is a possible shift in how we interact with the internet. And the reason why I say that is sites like Google, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, want to make it as easy as humanly possible for you to sign up. You have an email address, you know how to type in that email address and a password. Great. You have an account. Let's get you going. And the things that are afterthoughts to them is one, privacy, because their model for wealth generation is to data mine you for advertising purposes. So obviously come on board. Let's forget the privacy. That would include anybody just saying, yes, I am 13 or older when they're not 13 or older. And two, cybersecurity. They don't apply aggressive cybersecurity methodology when you sign up, even though those tools are available. So for example, most people when I'm talking to audiences, have no idea that Facebook has two-factor authentication. They have no clue. They didn't know that was there. Most people don't. Oh, you know, because they're not prompted for it. It's buried. You have to click on settings and then privacy and then go to like authentication or security. You know, there's a whole bunch of steps as opposed to, hey, click here to make your profile 10 times safer and here's how. You know, so we see this all the time in the industry. This is not new by any stretch of the imagination. So I think these congressmen and these child advocacy groups are 100% right. Now, that said, I don't know how much you can police this or what that methodology would be. So if you wanted to sign up for a YouTube account or a Google account, do you now have to, you know, take a picture of your driver's license and upload it to Google? In which case, what kind of privacy are they possibly data mining you for? You know, how does that violate your privacy rather? So what is the lesson here? What is the balance here? You know, maybe it's some kind of stringency where multiple passwords or authentications need to be put in. You know, I don't know. But if we are validating our passwords, you know, or rather validating our identities, then we are also giving our identities out to parties that we don't necessarily want them to have our full information. Like, I have no problem, you know, saying that, oh, Facebook knows who Nick Espinoza is. I have a public Facebook page. I hope all of you like, follow, and watch the videos on and interact with me on. Same with LinkedIn. Same with Twitter. You know, but I've never had to submit a driver's license to LinkedIn or to Twitter or to anything. And I'm perfectly fine with that. Now, on the downside is that somebody could go ahead and say, oh, well, you know, screw that Nick Espinoza guy, and I'm going to make my own Nick Espinoza page and do a whole bunch of awful things that make Nick Espinoza look like a jerk. And yeah, I mean, I have to go through a dispute process or something like that. Unfortunately, that's never happened, and I hope none of you ever do that to me. I'd appreciate it if you didn't. But these things happen. And so where's the balance with this? And we're going to find out. I mean, we're going to see where that happens. And when we are looking at the age of disinformation and fake news and Russian hacking and all of that, no matter where you stand, we have a lot of hyperbole and a lot of things flying all over the place. We're going to see where that ends up. But how we handle our children's ability to get online and access content that they should or should not do may fundamentally dictate how in the future we're going to have to log in and access these sites. That may rewrite the book a bit. And so we're going to see where this goes, but it's two congressmen out of 535 and multiple child advocacy groups, and Google's a massive company. So nothing may come of this, but at least it's being brought to your attention. So make sure that you are policing your kids when they're online, and especially if they're under the age of 13, YouTube.com is probably not the most appropriate place for them to be viewing things. So take that for what it's worth, but that is your child advocacy news of the week. And now for the deep dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a deep dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP. Again, that's Nick A. ESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin. And this week's deep dive is the future of the internet in 2028. And we basically are continuing to grow, and we're continuing to evolve our internet connections, our internet infrastructure, how we interact with this, the products that we use. I mean, there's on and on and on and on. There's so much that goes on in the internet. And there's a lot of people that have, you know, made predictions about where the internet's going to be in a decade from now, etc. But some of the people that are making the predictions actually have the ability to shape and craft the internet, and not just the internet, but how we interact with this. And one of the big battles that seems to be going on right now is the ability for a person, a consumer, an individual to have privacy on the internet versus the products that they're using online, such as free social media, free search engines, free a whole bunch of everything else that wants to track you to the nth degree. Basically, you are paying for your ability to use these products with your personal information, with your personal data. That is the balance that we are taking. But we also see that in many ways, there are governments around the world that are rather authoritarian in nature. And so what ends up happening is they start creating, internet and policies and censorship and all of this that has privacy advocates up in arms even more. It's not just one fact of you willingly saying, okay, well, you can track me for advertising purposes while I search for, you know, I don't know, whatever you're into, cars, right? So now you're going to get car advertising versus, you know, here's a government that's going to search what you're doing to make sure that you are buying the right kind of car. Otherwise, you are an enemy of the state. And that is what we see. And so today we're going to be talking about what the future of the internet looks like according to Google, because there's a lot of things that Google is doing right now that, well, a lot of privacy advocates have serious issues with, myself included, and how they are helping to shape the internet into something that I think, at least for some parts of the world, are going to be rather unrecognizable. Now, if you're not familiar with Eric Schmidt is one of the founders of Google. Him and Sergey Brin founded Google back in the 1990s. Obviously, he is one of the world's wealthiest men at this point, and while him and Sergey run now Alphabet, which is the umbrella company that owns Google and a slew of other companies, basically they want to have one company for every letter in the alphabet, A through Z, G being Google, they basically founded and created Google and is now run by a man named Sundar Pichai, who is a CEO. But recently at an event that Eric Schmidt was asked to talk at, he talked about what the internet is going to look like in 2020. And this is his vision for this. Now, I want you to take this in for a moment and really contemplate the words that he's saying, because I'm going to back this up with a whole bunch of information and action and direction that Google is taking to kind of make this happen or to kind of support this. Or maybe they simply just realized, you know what, this is inevitable. And so if we don't jump on the bandwagon, we're going to miss out. And so let's begin. And I quote Eric Schmidt here. I think the most likely scenario now is not a splintering, but rather a bifurcation into a Chinese-led internet and a non-Chinese internet led by America. If you look at China, and I was just there, the scale of the companies that are being built, the services being built, the wealth that is being created is phenomenal. Chinese internet is a greater percentage of the GDP of China, which is a big number, than the same percentage of the US, which is also a big number. If you think of China as, oh yeah, they're good with the internet, you're missing the point. Globalization means they get to play too. If you think you're going to see fantastic leadership in products and services, I think you're going to see fantastic leadership in products and services from China. There's a real danger that along with those products and services comes a different leadership regime from government with censorship controls, etc. Look at the way BRI works, their Belt and Road Initiative, which involves 60-ish countries. It's perfectly possible those countries will begin to take on the infrastructure that China has with some loss of freedom. Now, basically what Eric Schmidt is setting up is, there's essentially two internets. There's two infrastructures, which is very possible. I mean, you can have a large corporation with 100 locations basically create what is called an intranet that is kind of like an internet only accessible to that organization. And I'm obviously using the most basic terms, but it is very possible that the Chinese government could do this. And if they are making inroads into roughly 60 countries, bringing economic opportunity, bringing infrastructure, whether it's roads, buildings, internet, whatever that is, it's very possible that China could lead this. And so this is the vision that Google has of this. And if you think, well, Nick, it's just Eric Schmidt. I mean, he can say whatever he wants, but that's not what Google would do. Then you haven't been paying attention to the news, and that's perfectly fine because you're getting the news from me. And so I've probably talked about this in one of my news segments a couple of weeks ago, but we're going to dive into this a bit more. Now, Google has created something that they have called Project Dragonfly. Now, this project was a secret project within Google. Of the 80,000-ish employees that Google has, only a couple hundred knew about its development or were actively working on it. And it recently came to light, and it was so, I don't want to say damaging, but it was so shocking to most Google employees that Google had to have a company-wide meeting of all of their employees to actually explain what's going on and to support Project Dragonfly and all of that. Now, what Project Dragonfly is a custom-designed search engine similar to the Google that we have here, but it is designed for the Chinese government, which means it is tracked to the nth degree. Now, what I mean by that is it's being developed for the Android platform because obviously Google owns Android and a lot of us have Androids like Samsungs and, you know, HTCs and, you know, take your pick. And this would replace the standard Google search engine for citizens in China, but it tracks citizens to the nth degree. So you have your Android phone and you're a Chinese citizen and you go ahead and you search something in Project Dragonfly, it is going to tag that search to your phone number, which is registered to you because China is very stringent with how they register phones. It's going to look through your search history and patterns using AI to kind of understand what you've been searching on. And then it's going to give you a social media score. China currently has a social media score. And so if you're saying disparaging things on social media, for example, they lower your points. And if you get low enough points on any one of the categories, then you get denied services like public transportation. And if you can't catch a bus or a train, how are you going to get to work? You're listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show. We'll be back right after this quick message.